Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Carissa Nitschy.
And today we're mixing it up a bit. We've brought on Carissa, who is our resident expert on Central and Eastern Europe. And that's because we are going to do a deep dive and have a discussion on Poland's presidential election, the second round of which was just held on July 12th. And that election saw the incumbent Andrzej Duda, backed by the Law and Justice Party, very narrowly defeat Rafael Trzaskowski, who's the current Warsaw mayor, backed by the Civic Platform. The election, I think, was so notable in large part because Duda went to such great lengths to tilt the playing field in his favor. And so for us, this election has really raised a lot of questions about the state of democracy in Poland and how Duda will govern a divided Poland. And so to help us address those questions, we've got two fantastic guests today. We've got Dalibor Rohak and Melissa Hooper. And just a brief background on both. Dalibor is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies transatlantic relations and political trends in Central and Eastern Europe. And Melissa is a lawyer and rule of law expert. She's the director of the Foreign Policy and Human Rights Advocacy Program at Human Rights First, where she researches anti-democratic trends in Russia and in Central Europe. And she also teaches international human rights law at Arizona State University. So Melissa, Dalibor, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, great to be with you.
Maybe we can just start with a really kind of generic question just to lay down some of the groundwork. And Melissa, we can start with you. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about how this whole entire election, the campaign, how it went down, and some of the things that you found most notable about the process.
Sure. I think one of the most notable issues is, of course, that this was occurring during COVID-19, that the original election was supposed to be held May 10th, and that there, you know, originally the government, the Law and Justice government, was actually trying to push that election to happen, despite the fact that there are serious health risks that would you know, be felt if people were out in the streets voting. But that they thought it was so politically important for them to have this election and get their person cemented in, that they considered actually pushing the election forward. And at the last minute, there was a deal made with one of the, you know, not the main opposition party, but with a opposition party, in order to do this very strange machination where there was no election held, but it was not formally actually postponed. So they didn't have to declare a state of emergency and state that there were health concerns. It gave gave Law and Justice control over when the election would be held in the future. But you know, they essentially declared that there would be kind of like a ghost election, that the election would be nullified, and then it, you know, no one would actually go vote. So that is one of the strange aspects of this election and how we got here. And then I will just say a second aspect is that then in May, recognizing that the opposition candidate was Malgorzata Kidawa Blonska, was doing very poorly, had no personality and was not gaining votes, the opposition was able to change their candidate to Trzaskowski. And that was very smart, because he had gained a lot of attention and really started gaining momentum. And it's incredible that in the 2 months that he had from May 15th to July 12th, that he was able to really gain the momentum that he did.
Dalibor, you want to add anything on there?
I think in some sense, those early weeks before the original date of the election were even worse than the way Melissa described them, because at some point this insisted that not only the election would go ahead on May 10th, but it would be turned into a mail election only. And there was no time, no preparation for this. They had this bill passed through the lower house, which was then held up in the Senate, and until really a few days before the election, Kaczynski and large part of this insisted that the vote by mail would go ahead. And actually the bill that they had would strip the powers of the Independent Election Commission and would give full control over the process to the postal service, which was under PIS control. So actually it was a breath of relief on my part when this didn't happen and we had just a postponement of the election.
I wanted to ask, I mean, we've certainly heard, you know, quite a bit about the erosion of democracy in Poland. Kind of it's all in the same breath when we talk about the state of democracy in Poland or in Europe. Hungary and Poland kind of closely follows all in the same breath. Were you surprised that the election was as close as it was?
The election's result wasn't out of line with the polls we saw before the election. I think there still is a distinction to be made between Poland and Hungary. Well, yes, PiS has colonized public broadcasting, has eroded the independence of the judiciary. Melissa and I have written about the subject on several occasions, but I don't think these developments have moved as have been as advanced as in Hungary, where really it's very hard to compete on a even remotely level playing field for opposition candidates.
And I would say I was not surprised. Because while the Polish government has been making huge changes in terms of, I think, really harming the judiciary and the way it functions, taking aim at public media as well, that you have seen massive protests in response. And so the public is concerned. And when you have a public that is going out into the streets about a court, about a constitutional court, there is definitely a level of concern. And so you've even seen the government step back a couple of times on legislation because of massive protests. So that there really is a large number of the population that is concerned. And Trzaskowski was able to tap into that. And then I would also point out that even in the 2015 election, it wasn't that the Law and Justice Party really, you know, won this overwhelming majority like in Orbán's Hungary. They really did. They didn't even win in 2015 with that broad majority.
Why do you think that there's been so much more public backlash in Poland than Hungary? Is it because Polish public has the advantage of being able to see what has taken place in Hungary, and so they can kind of see where some of these things may be headed? Is it more of a kind of cultural explanations, longstanding kind of commitment to democracy in Poland that maybe wasn't present in Hungary? How do you account for why we've seen so much more public backlash in Poland and that has been the kind of guardrail that it has been in Poland, but not as much in Hungary?
Well, that's a really interesting question. My general take on this is that Poland is a country that is comparatively more urbanized, has more centers of decision-making power, very broadly speaking, has much larger authority, much larger population, and it's much harder to sort of centralize the decision-making authority in the way Orbán did in Hungary. Orbán's Hungary is a country where really Hungarian businesses have to be politically connected in order to prosper. If you are publishing a magazine, you have to behave in a certain way, toe the party line in order to get government advertising. It's very difficult to sustain journalism these days. Anyway, and also lots of Hungarians have left the country, maybe close to 500,000. Lots of Poles have left as well. But I think there is much more sort of back and forth. I think Poles are less keen to sort of give up on their country as opposed to Hungarians who, you know, have now found their living in Germany or Austria or London. I don't have a sort of all encompassing sociological explanation for why this is. You know, partly it's also because Orbán has been in power for a decade now, and many of these changes that have happened seem now irreversible.
I would also say that there is a really, I think, robust and strong civil society in Poland. There is this tradition, I think, you know, Solidarity, which actually, you know, initiated the acts that led to the the Iron Curtain coming down was in Poland. And I think that there is a really robust tradition of a really pluralistic civil society in Poland, and you have less of that in Hungary. So I would say that contributes.
So if we look at the election results, I mean, this was extremely close. And a lot of analysts have talked about these divisions that they're seeing in Poland and have talked a little bit about how Duda will now be governing a divided Poland. And this has kind of come up in terms of a rural city divide. There's been a little bit of some arguments on social media about whether we can see this as an east-west divide in Poland. What will be some of the challenges for Duda in governing with, you know, such a narrow margin of victory?
Yes, there will be challenges. The Senate is still opposition controlled, though the upper house of parliament, where it's the Sejm, so it is under control of Law and Justice. I don't know that Duda would see these as necessarily see the challenge as trying to rule a divided Poland. I think he will interpret the challenge as how to push through law and justice policies in order to make it more, in order to make it easier for law and justice to gain momentum for the next election. I think that we are, you know, we're likely to see that Duda and Law and Justice are not going to step back as we would, you know, as Trzaskowski suggested that maybe he should in his, when he conceded the election. We are going to see that Duda's going to push forward. Law and Justice will start taking on independent media. I mean, Kaczynski just came out yesterday with a statement saying that, you know, foreign media is misrepresenting Poland, and so we need to bring media into line so that it would more clearly represent what Poland looks like. I think that, you know, there are major divisions that have been called out by the European Court of Justice regarding the judiciary, and that came to a head in January, and then with a ruling in the case of Judge Tuleya in February. I think that now you're going to see the government push forward with a real takeover of the Supreme Court, you know, completing its takeover of the judiciary. So, I mean, the challenge is going to be how the Senate by itself could try to put impediments there, and then for civil society to be calling attention through, you know, from the international community, other international voices, and where there can be checks and balances, because there are going to be fewer in Poland.
I couldn't agree more with Melissa on this. This wasn't an election that was primarily about how Poland will be governed, but I think the question before the voters was one about whether the power of peace will be checked over the next 3 years until there is a parliamentary election in 2023. I mean, the president himself doesn't hold that much governing authority in Poland. He's largely a ceremonial figure, and I think his importance is related to the veto he can exercise over legislation. The Senate has a veto power as well, but the president's veto power is stronger. It requires a supermajority in the lower house in the Sejm. So the Senate at most, which is controlled by the opposition, can at most hold up legislation for a month, but then its veto can be broken by the lower house. And now, yeah, with Duda as a president, I think, you know, we can expect this to be less restrained than it would have been otherwise. But the other part of your question, which I found interesting, was this question of this political divide that exists within Poland. And I think because these divides are something that should be perfectly understandable to an American. I mean, it's this divide between a more conservative, more Catholic in this case, poorer rural Poland, and the more cosmopolitan, more outward-looking, more liberal urban Poland. Cities like Warsaw and Krakow and cities in the West. And I think this was very much on display in this election. And what this tried to do, maybe we can discuss this in greater detail in the coming minutes, was that it tried to leverage the sort of cultural dimensions of this divide by talking about, you know, LGBT rights and depicting Truskovsky as some sort of cosmopolitan proponent of free love, and some of these accusations were actually quite distasteful, really bordering on sort of accusing him of you know, all sorts of sexual depravity. So, but you know, clearly that has some resonance in some parts of the electorate.
Kind of following up on this question of civil society pushing back on a lot of what may be Duda 2.0's agenda for his second term. One question I have, I mean, what is the EU's role in this? We've seen how early intervention from the EU, at least on questions of judiciary independence, have been pretty effective in Poland and in rolling back a lot of Duda's term one agenda. But what is their role now? I mean, I noticed Ursula von der Leyen congratulated him via Twitter on his reelection bid. I mean, where should the EU be on these issues, and in particular on issues that they have a little bit less experience in recent years pushing back on, like media independence and civil society freedoms and academic freedoms?
So I would agree that there has been some, the EU in some ways has been successful, but I would say in particular, the EU courts, the Court of Justice of the European Union, has been successful at pushing back at some of the major initiatives that have tried to take over the judiciary. The EU, the European Commission, with infringement proceedings and with the Article 7 procedure, has lagged and has had little backbone and has wavered and has just not done very much. And so it really has fallen to the court system to make clear statements that what Poland is doing is against European values. And that's been interesting, because then in response, you have seen the Polish government sometimes say, well, we're not going to pay attention to the rulings like we do in our own country. And that's where, while you know, you're not likely to see a Polexit. I mean, Poles are overwhelmingly pro-EU, but if the government continues to say it's not going to uphold the rulings of a European court, and if it does decide not to, especially with a ruling that came down in the fall of last year that declares some of its institutions essentially illegally constituted and not functioning, you could see something that kind of looks like maybe a zombie within the EU. I don't know, maybe like Turkey is to NATO as Poland is to the EU, like not really, you know, fully part of it, but in name only. So, you know, the EU does need to be more active, of course. I think that the budgetary procedure is where you see this action happening. The fact that they're tying the 2021 to 2027 budget to rule of law measurements, that is good. And we can hope that that will move through, except that the fact that Central European countries are opposing it because they know that they may get less money may mean it gets watered down. And so that's where I think we have to be looking in the future. And that's where I hope that the EU will maintain some backbone and keep those provisions.
I think right now the budgetary question is the really important one. So yes, there was the Commission's proposal to tie the disbursement of structural funds to rule of law metrics, which was met with opposition in certain quarters in Central Europe. But I think going forward, the big question is how will the 750 billion recovery package for the fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic be distributed? Traditionally, Poland, with you know, various other countries, have been among the largest per capita recipients of EU funds. And this has certainly played a role in the sort of the thinking of peace and as well as Orban, where really this is free money coming out of the pockets of European taxpayers that can be then sort of distributed in a fairly discretionary way by the government. And there are interest groups close to the political party that do benefit. And I think, you know, turning off that spigot or making sure that the money comes with strings attached, or is sort of managed differently from how it was managed in the past. I think that could make a meaningful difference. But the question is, you know, like the EU right now has many fishes to fry, so to speak. And there is, I think, an urgent need to reach some sort of consensus on this budget question, on the recovery package. Because this is sort of money that needs to go out of the way as soon as possible if Europe is going to avoid a major recession.
So I think it's really helpful to hear kind of the way that the EU is approaching Poland, and there certainly are some tools that the EU has in play. You've talked about the kind of the judiciary and the EU budget as kind of two of the primary tools. But what do you see as the role for the United States? Does the US have a role here? Is there anything that the United States should be doing that it isn't doing in terms of some of the negative trajectory that we're seeing inside of Poland? We obviously, under this administration, have seen a pretty different approach. You had the very kind of dubious White House visit that Duda had right before his election. Most of the conversation between the United States and Poland seems to be centered around kind of defense cooperation. And so do you see that as kind of detracting from the United States' ability to exert any pressure on the democracy and human rights space? Just broadly speaking, assuming that you had a change of administration come 2021, what kind of things should the United States be doing to try to encourage and shine a light on some of the issues that we're seeing inside Poland?
That's a great question. I think, you know, the U.S.-Polish relationship is a strong one. Poland is an important ally. It's a country that takes its NATO obligations seriously. It finds itself in what it perceives as a fairly dangerous neighborhood. So those ties will be very strong, no matter who's in the White House, who's in power on either side of the Atlantic. Under this present administration, I did not welcome this move in Washington that sort of aimed to really refound the relationship on the basis of some shared ideological affinity between Trump and the Law and Justice Party. If you remember the speech he gave in 2017 in Warsaw, I wasn't particularly fond of that because it really is another way of inserting oneself into these cleavages that exist within Polish society. And, you know, it is imaginable that one day we'll have, you know, a Trump-like administration in Washington and a different government in Poland. And so you want to have as much continuity, as much common ground across political parties on those sides of this relationship. That said, in terms of holding Poland to account, Poles will listen very carefully, I think, to what comes out of Washington. And although I'm not expecting anything from this administration, you know, at moments when people on the Hill spoke out, particularly when you had, you know, conservative members, senators, people from the GOP, I think peace is very very, very sort of sensitive to voices from those circles. Melissa can I guess talk about that in greater detail. If there is a change of administration in Washington this November, I think one thing I would warn against would be into having a sort of symmetrical problem to the one we are having these days, which is to say that we might end up with a sort of democratic administration that will try to insert itself into these within Poland cleavages in a different way. Right? You had these things happening under Obama administration at many occasions. You know, the ambassador Normeisen famously endorsed the Prague Pride March in 2009. It looked like a completely innocuous thing. It led to to massive scandal in the Czech Republic, and you thought, you know, this was a trivial thing, but it did have repercussions. So I think we need to, in America, have a rethink of how we promote democracy and values in a way that is cognizant of the fact that the United States is itself deeply polarized, and many of these countries we are engaging with are deeply polarized, And I think we need to have something like a sort of democratic minimalism package that we try to promote and stick with no matter who is in power in Washington or who is in power in those other countries. I think that would be a useful thing going forward.
Yeah, I agree with Delvor that that the U.S. and especially, you know, what Washington says and when Washington speaks about what's happening in Poland, Poland does pay attention. The Polish government listens because it does see the U.S. as a major contributor to its security. And so, for example, when you have had the U.S., when you've had bipartisan senators Cardin, McCain, Durbin wrote a letter to the Polish government in 2016 expressing concern about rule of law. That is what they said. There was a huge reaction in Poland. Who are these people? What are they saying? Just from this bipartisan letter. But even after that, you've seen the administration, even the Trump administration, put out statements on a couple of occasions. One was in July 2017 about some of the laws in the Supreme Court, and one was about the quote, Holocaust law, the law that would have permitted criminal defamation, essentially charges for statements that that indicated Poland was complicit in the Holocaust and other actions towards Jews in World War II. Those two times when the administration spoke out, Poland backed up, it repealed or didn't sign provisions of the laws. And so if the US does speak, you can get Poland's attention. And if there is a new administration, I think just simply making a statement about some of the most problematic for democracy policies. And again, when I speak about this, I'm talking about rule of law. I'm talking about whether your judiciary is independent and whether, you know, any person who goes into a court can get a fair trial. I'm talking about those kinds of things. If we can talk about, if we can have a U.S. voice talking about constitutionalism and rule of law, just I think that could start to leverage some positive movement in Poland.
Just a quick follow-up question. I don't know to what extent you are tracking how Polish citizens have responded to and reacted to current recent events here in the United States, meaning kind of what kind of ground do you think that the United States now has to stand on if we're now turning to Poland and talking about issues like rule of law, democracy? Do you think that there is a perception in other countries that kind of our leverage or our ability to have those types of discussions has somehow been diminished by both many of the things that Trump himself has done, by our issues with racial inequality in our own country? It feels to me like we're going to have a new conversation, that we're not going to be able to come in and express concern the way that we have in the past. I know this, it's a hard question, but you know, from a democracy and human rights perspective, how do you think events in our own country over the last couple of months has shifted our ability to have these discussions internationally, including with Poland?
It's interesting because I do have regular conversations with civil society groups in Poland and elsewhere about what the US should be doing. And there is a very strange, I think, lag in the absorption of what is happening in the US. And I think still a reticence to be critical of the US and our, you know, our racial justice sort of struggles and our rule of law struggles. I think that where, you know, we have a reputation that seems to still exist in the minds of pro-democracy activists and advocates. And I think that it may be in part that there is just an ideal that has been developed and it's hard to give up that ideal. And so the US still holds power. I agree that that is going to diminish over time and as our struggles continue. And so the US will need to rethink how it presents democracy assistance. And I think Dalmore mentioned that earlier. I think we're headed in that direction. We're all thinking about it. It needs to be done, you know, more focused on partnerships or more focused on, you know, how we all need to move toward these ideals. It's just strange that there is still a lag, and the ideal of the United States is so difficult to give up, I think, for us, but also for our counterparts overseas.
I haven't seen much, if any, European polling on the Black Lives Matter protest movement in the United States, but my intuition is that, like everything, this is in Europe filtered, including Poland, through partisan ideological lenses, that people see what they want to see. In certain countries, I would expect this would have added to the already existing stock of casual anti-Americanism, which became augmented during the Trump years. But I would imagine that in Poland, as a country that historically, when you look at the polling, has had very strong positive sort of attitudes towards the US, the reaction, and even there were these like small scale public gatherings in Central Europe, including I think in Poland, like this wasn't so much a sort of negative response to what's happening in America or a sort of sense of moral superiority. I think many Europeans do feel like they are, to some extent, perhaps because of America's cultural sort of dominance in the world, they feel like we are part of the American conversation and they want this country to succeed. They sort of understand that the United States is a complicated and in many ways flawed country. But I think, especially in Central Europe, there is this sort of sense that America still is an indispensable country and one that has a capacity for renewal. So I wouldn't think that these protests and the debates that are reverberating through the American conversation have been in and by themselves damaging to America's stature in the world. I think the world is looking. The world is, you know, has very keen interest in America making progress on these issues, obviously.
So the conversation has, of course, been pretty dismal, as is often the case in Brussels sprouts. So I have a question that speaks a little bit to a bright spot here. So it was a close election. By all accounts, we can really see Trzaskowski's campaign as a success in some ways. What do you think are some lessons learned for opposition parties around Europe and around the world? I mean, what notes should they be taking from Trzaskowski's campaign to apply in their home countries?
I think that the Polish opposition has finally learned to unite across at least its basic differences. And that has taken longer than it should have. Unfortunately, but it was when it finally came together, I think the success that it met with, or you know, the level of success, is hopefully something that will bolster future cooperation. I mean, you have also started to see this in other places. There were united candidates that were run in the last Hungarian municipal elections. And so I think you're starting to see opposition groups understand that their own divisiveness and their own polarization is not going to help. So I think that is a lesson. I think that it was also heartening to see that Trzaskowski is emphasizing rule of law, is emphasizing a way forward, an open society, and that spoke to a lot of Poles. That spoke to, you know, at least about half of Poles. So in light of the really rancorous and you know, targeted and even vile, you know, statements targeting him, saying he's, you know, treasonous, and anti-Semitic statements that he's giving money to the Jews, and the fact that he didn't have any media access because public media was all, you know, very slanted toward Duda, the fact that he was able to get that percentage of the population with all of these obstacles stacked against him, I think really shows that there is a desire for a a forward-looking liberal democratic polling. And so I think that was a lesson as well.
It's worth saying that it took almost a decade in Hungary for the opposition forces to realize that they have to work together across partisan and ideological lines. Coalitions have been formed even with Jobbik, which is the far right, once neo-fascist party, just in order to defeat Fidesz candidates in various municipalities. And so if Poles understand that already, that you have to work together, you have to get above the narcissism of small differences, I think that's in and by itself good news. I think the other part of good news is that the opposition in Poland, which is much stronger than the one in Hungary, understands that you have to have good candidates and you have to be able to do politics. You can't allow yourself to be so trapped in your little, ideological bubble and listen to, friendly commentators from sort of, urban liberal newspapers, but you have to be able to actually reach out to the broader electorate. I think Platforma, the civic platform, is in a good position to perhaps win the next election. Poland is in that sense a different country from Hungary. I think it's going to be difficult though, because partly because of social media and the way politics is conducted in these proportional systems, it is very easy to succumb to this balkanization of political life where people try to play their little games and have their little parties catering to, parochial small sets of concerns rather than building national movements. And that is something that this has been able to capitalize on very well.
What role do you think Trzaskowski's current role as mayor of Warsaw played in all of this and in his campaign to reach out to local electorates and smaller villages and rural areas in Poland? And then do you think that this may become a model, these mayors catapulting to national leadership, kind of thinking about in upcoming elections, maybe Imamoglu in Turkey, maybe the mayor of Budapest in Hungary? Is this something that you think we'll see around the world?
I think you also see even in Russia, Sobyanin for a little while for his handling of COVID had a moment. And I don't know how long that will last, but it is interesting to see kind of how these local level leaders are able to take on authoritarian leaders.
Right before the pandemic, actually, there was an initiative by mayors of the four of the capital cities of the four Visegrad countries. There was like an open letter or some sort of statement. Britain in favor of open society and essentially trying to balance the governments that were in place in all four of these countries. So I think all of these four capital cities you have very interesting mayoral figures, and I think all four of them potentially have prospects in national politics.
I think it helps that because of COVID, they are managing something that is a national issue. So they're getting attention for that. And that gives them a leg up in terms of media when, in, for example, both Hungary and Poland, you have media entirely controlled by the ruling party. So you're not going to get positive media just for being, but because of COVID, they could get more attention and just being a mayor, I think, gives them a little bit of a leg up there. So yeah, I think you could see a model coming out of this.
As a final question, just to kind of dust off your crystal balls and thinking forward about what you can expect in Poland, would you say that you're, after this election, more optimistic than you were before about the way that trends are headed there? Or are your concerns just as strong as they were before? I don't know, just dust off that crystal ball. What are you looking at? What trends do you think merit us watching most closely? Are there any kind of upcoming events that you think folks need to be paying attention to? Kind of what's your prognosis, your forecast for the way that democracy and human rights trends are likely to go in Poland over the next 4 or 5 years? Big question, I know.
So if we're going to talk 4 or 5 years, So I would say that I am pessimistic for the immediate future, but still remain optimistic in the longer shooting future. I think that we will, in the immediate future, not see a step back by Peace, that they will continue to try to take over the judiciary and now have the power to do it, take over the Supreme Court, which has been the last bastion of independence that will happen. We'll see, you know, individual judges that have been really, I think, strong members of civil society and voices, they're going to lose their jobs. So we're going to see attacks and criminal prosecutions of judges. I think you're going to see the private media law or some semblance of it that has been sort of held in reserve. You'll see some regulation of media. With Kuczynski mentioning specifically American-owned TVN in his statement yesterday, and calling out German media and American media, I think you will see more media regulation, so that even private media is going to suffer more than it has, which has already been a lot. And I think that with this, with a very close electoral win, I think that you'll see some electoral machinations that they will be trying in the next few years. You have this extraordinary appeal body that controls electoral decision-making, and when there are disputes, I think that they may try to strengthen that body or create some other body that would give them more power in future elections so that this doesn't happen again. But I do think that, looking forward, I don't know really that they'll be able to cow the civil society and the strong, I think, concerns or expressions of concern and worry of people that are going out in the streets saying that this is not what they're looking for in their government. So I think that you will still hopefully see progress forward looking toward future elections.
Dalibor, optimistic, pessimistic?
I don't think my outlook has changed dramatically with this election. There are reasons to be concerned over the next 3 years. For me, the big question going forward is the question of business economic policy. So for a long time, we've known that the growth models of the Central European countries are not sustainable into indefinite future, right? Having this sort of relatively low level manufacturing driven by foreign investment, that you have to sort of move into a sort of different category of like doing things if you want to prosper as a country, and you haven't seen those transitions happen yet in Slovakia, Hungary or Poland. But now on top of that, we have this massive economic shock with COVID-19 that's going to accelerate many of these things. People are worried about the decline of automobile manufacturing. Like, all of this is going to happen much faster than anticipated. And the question is, what will this do in response? Because many of these governments, whether it's Fidesz or PiS, like, they can actually behave pretty irresponsibly in bad economic times, and political and economic populism goes hand in hand, and if you have a situation in which there is a financial crisis, debt crisis in Poland, obviously I don't think Pole exit is in the cards, but you could have a much more difficult conversation with Brussels if Poles were really cornered by economic events.
Well, this has been really fantastic. I want to thank both of you, Melissa and Dalibor, for joining us. I mean, there's obviously just been a lot of discussion about the health and the strength and the resilience of democracy in Europe. Poland has often been at the center of those conversations and discussions. So it's really helpful to hear kind of you break down some of these trends, better understand what we need to be looking at and watching. And I think, again, just looking forward with both of you and with the larger community of continuing these discussions about what the role is for outside actors, for how the United States, in conjunction with the EU, should be approaching Poland, particularly now that I feel like the ground has shifted beneath us. And so what will these conversations look like moving forward what are the points of US leverage and influence in affecting these outcomes? So having these kinds of conversations, I think, just really help shed a lot more nuance on those discussions. So really appreciate you taking the time to be here. And I hope that we're able to come back together again and maybe in a, have a more even an optimistic conversation about things turning around in Poland sometime soon. So thanks to both of you.